Hi, and welcome back to our class, Jesus Through Her Eyes, a class that looks at Jesus' interactions with women in the Gospels. I'm Larissa.
And I'm Olivia.
This week, we'll be looking at John 11 and the resurrection of Lazarus and Jesus' discussions with both Mary and Martha, his sisters. So before we read the passage, it would be useful for us to talk about what has happened up until this point in John to better understand how this story fits in the story of what John is doing. Olivia, do you want to talk a little about that?
Yeah. So the structure of the Gospel of John falls into basically two halves, with a prologue at the beginning and an epilogue at the end. So other than the prologue and epilogue, the book of John divides into what's called the Book of Signs, which picks up in John 1:19 and goes all the way through the end of chapter 12. And we see in this section descriptions of Jesus's miracles interspersed with conversations that Jesus has with various characters. And we talked about this a little bit a few weeks ago when we looked at John 4. Right. That conversation with Jesus and the Samaritan woman is an example of that. And then from John 13 through 20, this section of the book is known as the Book of Glory. And although glory appears as a theme earlier in the book, indeed we'll see it in this chapter, glory becomes a real theme kind of in a much more significant way in this latter half of the Gospel of John. But as is very true of the kind of complex, enigmatic, or even riddling style of the Gospel of John, the glory that Jesus has is, of course, bound up in the crucifixion, the most kind of inglorious suffering that an ancient reader might be able to imagine. Again, execution at the hands of an imperial state. So there is an irony in some ways to that claim about this being material, so interested in glory, because already we have bound up there a tension between glory and suffering. So this passage now, John 11, tells a miracle that is unique to the Gospel of John. So in comparison with the other Gospels, the Gospel of John tends to have more teaching and fewer miracles overall, but it does contain several unique miracles, and this is one of those.
That broader context brings us some color as we move into reading this passage, which is a long one this week. We will be reading John 11, verses 1 to 44, before we talk a bit more about its context and what we understand from it. So I'll begin reading that in verse 1. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, after he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was.
Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Those who walk during the day do not stumble, because they see the light of this world. But those who walk at night stumble, because the light is not in them." After saying this, he told them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he'll be all right." Jesus, however, had been speaking about his death, but they thought that he was referring merely to sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him."
When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord, I believe that you were the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world.
When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, The teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, See how he loved him. But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?
Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, already there is a stench because he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. One thing I'm initially struck by is some parallels with Jairus' daughter that we talked about a few weeks ago as the story surrounding the woman with the flow of blood. And I thought in particular about Jesus referring to Lazarus as the one who was sleeping, again, to his disciples here, in similar format, this resuscitation text in which, it almost seems that he's using either a colloquialism or talking about a cosmic reality, that he is not dead, that he's only sleeping, versus the tangible reality, right? That they have buried Lazarus and prepared him for burial. And I was thinking about that in this, in our own sequencing and the way those texts have been handled.
Yeah, you know, I think the only thing that I'll add to that is that in Mark, when Jesus says that Jairus' daughter is sleeping, the response of his listeners is to laugh at him, right? And we looked at these kind of moments in Mark 5 where Jesus is misunderstood or perhaps even frustrating to the disciples when he asks them who touched him. And here, although it's a similar disconnect between Jesus using language of sleep for someone who is dead. Right. The Gospel of John has this very, this love of riddles and this love of kind of multiple meanings. And so the way that this is presented here, the disciples still misunderstand him, but in some ways, the reader is kind of brought into the riddle. So, you know, the disciples right. think if he's fallen asleep, he's going to get better. But the narrator tells us that Jesus explicitly had been speaking about his death. And so we see already kind of Jesus using multiple meanings here in a way that the writer of the Gospel of John will employ also for thinking. I'm just looking at verse 4, when Jesus talks about the result of this illness is for God's glory so that the Son of Man may be glorified through it, right. that we know that the eventual exaltation of Jesus is another one of these kind of riddles in that it's exaltation through extreme humiliation and suffering.
Yeah, there's, I think this is fair to say that John imputes the full narrative back in, that his goal is often to drive us towards those theological ends, more so than we see in the synoptics, not that it doesn't exist, but he's willing to tell the end of the story at the beginning and weave those things together. So this text comes within John, like we mentioned some, shortly before we start moving towards the crucifixion.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting play here going on as it links to that. Olivia, do you want to talk a little about that, and particularly the view of the Jews as the text refers to them?
So we read through verse 44, but it's worth noting that as the reader moves through the Gospel of John, the pacing of the action and the kind of momentum towards the crucifixion picks up, as you said, Larissa, really soon after this story. So there are ways in which actually the response of other characters to the raising of Lazarus propels us directly towards the crucifixion. So in verse 45, we see that many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what he had done. And in verse 53, the Gospel of John says, from that day on, they planned to put him to death. And we have to pause here before we get into the specifics of this passage and what the raising of Lazarus reveals for us as we kind of think about these different women's interactions with Jesus. We have to pause on the character group that John calls the Jews. First, we have to bear in mind that crucifixion is a form of capital punishment that only the Romans had authority to carry out. So although the Gospels tell the story of the crucifixion in light of the resistance of some Jewish leaders to Jesus, there has been a kind of pernicious interpretation in the afterlife of the writing of the Gospels that blames Jews for the death of Jesus. And I cannot say enough times that that has to be rejected outright, historically, ethically, and it's unbelievably dangerous and has had real world and horrific effects throughout human history. But then the second thing that we have to grapple with, and this is more specific to the Gospel of John, is that the Gospel of John uses this label of the Jews for a kind of subgroup. If you notice in verse 45, many of the Jews who had come with Mary and seen what Jesus did believed in him. But then we see in verse 54, Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews. And so the Jews gets used here as a label for certain Jewish characters. And on the one hand, Jesus was Jewish. All of his earliest followers were Jewish. And this comes through in all of the Gospels, but the Gospel of John in some ways minimizes this fact. So the Samaritan woman labels Jesus as Jewish, and we know historically that Jesus was Jewish, that some Jewish people believed in him in the Gospel of John's telling, and other Jewish leaders resisted Jesus. There is also a legacy of anti-Jewish biblical interpretation that we have to reckon with, but scholars like Adele Reinhartz have made a really compelling argument, I think, that we have to take seriously already some anti-Judaism internal to the Gospel of John itself in the way that the Gospel uses this character group of the Jews. I think we can't look away from this as we're thinking about the ongoing significance of this text in the life of the church. It's something that we have to really grapple with. So we have to kind of remember historically that Jesus belongs firmly within Judaism, but we also have to, I think, wrestle with this really ethically difficult dimension of the text.
So given that broader narrative, it is telling that this story takes place in the home of a grieving Jewish family. We see Mary and Martha, and as the passage calls them, just the Jews, who are there to console them. So we have them sitting Shiva, as would have been Jewish custom, in their mourning with this broader Jewish community who've come to be with them from Jerusalem. And so we have these, these contours to work through, right? The the complications of John's handling of the Jews broadly, and then also these vignettes that have a Jewish family in mourning in positive light and with and being accompanied by Jews who are for the most part viewed positively. They have some mixed reviews, which we'll talk about at some point. But I think it's useful for us to move towards thinking about these two women grieving. Mm-hmm. And there's space to interpret these women differently. But one way that, and we've talked a bit about this already when we talked about them last week, is a bit of a temperament way of talking about things. And I like to read these two women, or at least I see a color of this, as having distinct grieving styles that map onto the behaviors that we saw in Luke 10. Mm-hmm. We have Martha, who is eager to meet Jesus and to make theological comments and to state facts. And we get very little emotiveness from her, right? She's getting stuff done. And then we have Mary, who we know is weeping and mourning. And when she encounters Jesus, does so with a rebuke of sorts. Like, you should have done something. You should have been here. Mm-hmm. Reading the two, it reminds me of the days following my own dad's death and the grieving of those surrounding, particularly of his brothers, and the way that they met that moment differently, right? The mm-hmm. the uncle who was like, here's the funeral liturgy, you know, after everyone arrived, who's doing what? And how are we going to get these things done? Mm-hmm. Let's work on divvying out his estate, right? Like that we have to get the things done, and here are the things that we're going to do. And then the brother who spent most of that week that we spent preparing for his funeral, looking at old pictures and reminiscing, right? Both were moving in grief in their own ways and asking mm-hmm. different questions. I do see when we look at Mary and Martha, right, the sense in which their temperaments come out and Jesus mm-hmm. meets them in their particular ways of grieving and the things that they are experiencing in those moments.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add there is I think you're right that their actions are really markedly different. Their statements are very, very similar, except that Mary, in the direct speech that she says to Jesus, the pronoun or the possessive there, my brother, is foregrounded. That's the only, it's a kind of shade of variation difference between what Martha says and what Mary says. And, you know, grammatically, it has kind of the overall same effect. It's perfectly a fine word order either way. But there's a shade more emphasis on the, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, from Mary. So I think that perhaps even in that subtle change, there is just a little extra kind of pathos. I think that's right.
Yeah. And we'll talk about each of these women separately in some more details, but to read those two things together, and both their declarations of faith and the sense of intimacy that we have, both of them encounter Jesus and both of them have these pseudo-private interactions with him, in which they name what they're feeling, right? The, had you been here, something else would have happened. And it's not, with Mary, it feels more like blame than with Martha. In part because Martha is quick to add, she says, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. There's this sense in which it almost seems like she's uncomfortable with sitting there and said, had you been here, this wouldn't have happened. And said, says, but I don't want to blame you. I know you can still do stuff, right? Like that's, maybe that's reading into the text some. Whereas Mary is comfortable just saying, had you been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't need to make any additional statement. She's just sitting with this person whom she believes has the power to heal, and who she feels has not done it, or whether or not it's his fault or simply unfortunate timing. She's willing to name that and sit in that weeping. So I think we'll continue to kind of pull out those contours of these two women and both their statements of faith and their statements of a frustration and intimacy with God. But I want us to look first at Martha, in part because Martha has this this first interaction. And yeah, I want to talk about what Martha says theologically, because again, here, like we saw in John 4, Martha is given some pretty significant theological knowledge and conversation. She is certainly conversant in the theology of her time. And so in her initial statement to him, she calls him Lord, and she affirms that he has the ability to do something still. It's not entirely clear what she thinks Jesus is going to do. It's certainly clear that she doesn't think that Lazarus is going to be walking out of that tomb at the end of the day, given her remarks. But she certainly thinks that Jesus is one whom God listens to, if not something more robustly than that, that he is one whom is able to be this intermediary. So she believes this about Jesus, and Jesus affirms what they both agree with, right? That her brother will rise again in this resurrection on the last day. This would have been a belief both Martha and Jesus affirm, and would have been true of the Pharisees' understanding of the afterlife, although it would not have been a view of the Sadducees, another sect of Judaism. And so she affirms these things, and yet Jesus pushes back on that, and we'll talk more robustly about the statement later. But he is calling her to something higher. He's meeting her comment, her theological assurance. And I read this and I think about all of the, for any of us who have grieved intimately the loss of a parent or a child or a spouse or even a grandparent, right? Those assurances that, you know, he's in a better place kind of comments. I read Martha's kind of retorts here as like as that same, is this like, I'm just gonna keep being told these things. I'm affirming these things are true. Like, this is my hope in my grief are these things. And what Jesus instead comes back and says, something more profound that she affirms, and yet it's clear that the whole gravity of what he's saying in verse 25, I'm the resurrection and the life, those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. The full gravity of that is not something she has grasped, either in this immediate context or potentially beyond that. But she comes back with this profound confession. Mm-hmm. She says in verse 27, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. And that that confession of faith is the most robust that we have seen thus far in John. And it parallels what we see Peter saying in Matthew 16.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But, you know, what's interesting is that the closest the Gospel of John gets to that kind of confession from Peter is in John 6. Right. I believe it's in verse 59. 69. But there, Peter calls Jesus the Holy One of God. The language of the Christ, the Son of God, this is reserved for Martha. And, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking, Larissa, there's so much that's left unsaid in this text. And this is, again, kind of part of the feel of the Gospel of John. I think it just invites repeated encounter and kind of puzzling out. And I think you're absolutely right that Martha, she's a real pragmatist. So, you know, she, when Jesus later on in the story says, mm-hmm. roll away the stone, she's the one who says, hold on, there's a smell. He's been dead for 4 days.
She's like, surely you can't mean to do
that. That's right. But I suppose I'm kind of inclined to read the conversation that Jesus and Martha have as being very similar to the conversation with the Samaritan woman, where there's almost this kind of theological one-upsmanship. And, you know, again, we can bring all kinds of different interpretive lenses to this dialogue because we only are told so much by the text. But, you know, I think I see with you a really profound statement of faith already in verse 22, where she says, even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. And then when Jesus says, your brother will rise again, and she affirms, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day, I suppose I also kind of see that as a pretty sincere statement of faith. And then, you know, there's what an unbelievable twist that in verse 25, Jesus says, I am the resurrection. So they're talking about this kind of shared belief in a future eschatological resurrection on the last day. And then for Jesus to say, I am this here and now. Even those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And what I love in verse 27 is that, you know, normally it's Jesus who is asked questions and then gives answers that are kind of completely tangential in a very rich sort of way, you know, the kind of productive refusal to answer questions as they're posed. But I think Martha is doing this here, actually. Yeah. He says, do you believe that I'm the resurrection and the life? And she is kind of like one-upping that. She says, you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. And I think that the reader here is meant to hear echoes of the prologue, where there's the language of the true light coming into the world. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I think Martha, in some ways, her speech is kind of a callback to that for the reader who's been moving through the gospel in this order.
Yeah. It's hard to read it and also not look back to John 4 in this, this affirmation of the resurrection, and then saying that I am the resurrection, and this the banter about the living water, and the affirmation that I am that living water, right? This, to see Jesus encountering both of these women and saying, I know what you were longing for, and let me make it explicitly clear that I am the one who is able to give you what you need. The Martha as this one-upmanship in her comment, I actually really like thinking of that, both in terms of like building out this color of Martha that we have, who in the, maybe fittingly, in the very next chapter is back to serving without any of the, at least any stated anxiousness or trouble that we saw in Luke 10. But that, yeah, that she's coming to Jesus knowing full well who he is. And yet, yeah, as we can kind of talk about in verse 39, right, is when they're all at the tomb now, and Jesus is telling them to roll away the stone, and Martha's like, hold up. You know, as we said, like, there's a smell, he's been dead 4 days. I don't, like, you're getting caught up in the moment. this pragmatism, as you say, she knows who he is and yet cannot possibly conceive in this moment what he's going to do. And I love seeing those two things together, because I think it's easy to say that she just doesn't have enough faith that he can do it. But we don't get any picture of that in this story. It's not that Martha has any inability of faith here. It's that what Jesus is doing is so beyond what it would be reasonable to expect. That, yeah, she's responding as would be expected. And so then to see this as not a limitation of Martha, but instead the profoundness of Jesus, I think is really important in understanding the dynamic at play here. And it's telling, right? She makes this comment, and then he kind of calls her out on it, says, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you'd see the glory of God? And then we have no further retort from Martha. She's like, roll the stone away, right? we don't have the color behind that, but presumably from what we've gotten so far is an affirmation that Jesus knows what he's doing.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, although, you know, Jesus knows what he's doing doesn't stop him from having some pretty strong emotional reactions in the midst of all of this, which I also think are quite profound.
So I think before we get to that, it's useful to go back to the start of the passage and see this initial encounter when Jesus is told about Lazarus's death. We're told that Mary and Martha send for Jesus, knowing that he can do something, that he can heal Lazarus. And so what the passage tells us in verse 5 and 6 is that he loves them. And after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed for 2 days longer. There's a little ambiguity in the word there, right? If that's despite the fact he loved them, he waited, or because he loved them. But either way, we don't have this urgency that we've been accustomed to talking about with Jesus. We have a lingering Jesus that is confusing at the very least, if not feels contrary to how you would respond if you in fact were able to heal someone and knew that there was urgency in that moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I think there's an element of mystery for sure. In Verses 7 and 8, the disciples provide one possible explanation, although it doesn't fully explain why Jesus has delayed, right? The disciples say, Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you. Are you going there again? And this is really why I think it's important to keep in mind what this kind of character group of the Jews, how they get used in negative ways throughout the Gospel of John. In verse 8, this is another example of that. In terms of the narrative, though, that might be an obstacle to Jesus's travels, but then he decides that it's worth it to go anyways. And so you're left wondering, well, why didn't he go immediately? It doesn't resolve, I don't think, the delay, even if it sort of presents an obstacle to his travels in 7 and 8.
Yeah. So we know that there's these two extra days, and we know that it's a 2 days journey. And so when Jesus arrives, he is 4 days past being informed, and coincidentally also 4 days past Lazarus' death. So presumably Lazarus dies sometime around when Jesus is called for, right? That that even if he had left right away, he would have been absent. But the women don't know this, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have any evidence to suggest that they have knowledge of his delay, or even when he would have found out, or what would have happened. Yeah, so we have this Jesus who knows that Lazarus is dead and still believes it's useful to go because he knows what work is ahead of him, but is not concerned by the immediacy here, which I think is helpful in then understanding the reactions both of the women and of Jesus when we have this encounter that is deeply emotive when Mary enters the scene.
Yeah.
So this is the folklore color that I add to this. I mentioned, as I keep mentioning, I tend to defend Martha over Mary. And when I read this, so we know that Martha goes right away to Jesus. Many of the commentaries suggested that Martha left in secret so that she could go alone, so she could have this private encounter. And that Mary doesn't know that Jesus is there. She hasn't gotten the same knowledge until Martha tells her. But the color that I have always read to it is that Mary and Martha both know. And Martha, in her dutifulness, shows up to see Jesus. And Mary is pouting at home and refusing to go and staying put. And so Martha comes back. And whether or not Jesus is actually called for her, it is a kindness to her sister to tell her this, because she is caring for her sister and knows that she will go to Jesus if she knows that she is called, he is called for, and that's the scene that we have. And for me, my initial reaction is something is wrong with Mary, right? What we have when Martha goes is that Mary remains in the house. We don't have any sense of why, or if she chose to stay or just did. And I want to rebuke her for not going to Jesus in that moment. But I'm want to say, even though, like, even if there is a take that Mary knows, which we don't know that Mary knows, I want to say that there's a take that it isn't wrong for her to have lingered, that she is grieving, and it has taken Jesus 4 days to show up. 4 days Lazarus has died, and Jesus isn't here yet. Other people are there to grieve with her, but her intimate friend, her Lord, is not there. Yeah, I don't know how useful this is in terms of interpretation, but just in terms of thinking about grief, which is important to talk about in this passage, I think there has to be space in our understanding of the kingdom for us to grieve and sulk when God's timing is not our own, even if we affirm that it is good, even if we affirm that God knows what he's doing and we don't. Because we live in this fallen world and we feel the consequences of those, even if we know that God is making all things right, that we can still grieve when things aren't right. And I feel like I'm adding a lot on the text to say that. But to read Mary as weeping and mourning at home, and then even the way that she comes to Jesus in her mourning and their encounter, to say that there is space for that kind of emotive faith, that isn't a inferior version of faith, or a sign of her lack of faith, as some have suggested, but instead a robustness and affirmation of the way that we have been made as people with emotions, and that God hears those things and accepts those things, and in some ways almost seems to affirm it, we have in this interaction between Mary and Jesus.
Yeah, and I think participates in it, even doesn't just sort of allow it, but that, you know, Jesus weeps because Mary is weeping, and the Jews who came with her in verse 33, and he has a really strong emotional reaction that is in some ways a little tricky to interpret. There are shades of anger in the language that's used here, and I think for me, rereading this text today, there's so much kind of narrative pacing, and then I see these two significant moments of pause. The first is in verse 6, where Jesus stays for 2 days where he is, and the second is where Jesus has this emotional reaction to Mary. And I think that first pause is very difficult to make sense of. And I think we have been in a season globally for a year this week that is also difficult to make sense of, that just presents us in an inescapable way with the unintelligibility of suffering. And although I don't find it kind of easy to explain or straightforwardly comforting that I see this unintelligibility of suffering here as well in this text, I think it's helpful to see it reflected back in a moment where so many of us have been grappling with this for so long. But then I think I also find something very moving about a portrayal of God as a human who weeps and is made angry in the face of suffering, because I think that has been the reaction of so many of us for a whole host of reasons over the last year.
Yeah, you know, we keep talking about this, the humanity of Jesus that comes out of these passages and these encounters. And the two-sided coin there, right? The grief, the sorrow, and the anger, and the way that they are intertwined, which feels very accurate, right? Mm-hmm. to see and acknowledge that Jesus as one and the same, with the one who comes in glory, with the one who is crucified, I think is really important. To recognize the contours of human experience, which Jesus knew. And we know that abstractly, but I think we see it much more concretely in this, this empathetic moment. He sees Mary weeping, and he too weeps. He is deeply moved, right? There's this, the word that is used there is often conveys a sense of anger, mm-hmm. not just sadness. And so there's this complex weeping going on, right? And we see him empathetically coming to grieve with her, even though he already knows what he's going to do, even though he knows Lazarus' death is temporary, both in terms of this immediate situation and in terms of an eschatological truth. Even though he knows those things, he stops in that moment to also weep and to also grieve the way that the world is. And whether our grief is about circumstances or, like Mary and Martha, about the deaths of those that we love, I think we have to be able to talk about space to grieve even when we know the outcomes. Mm-hmm. There's a trend. I experience it in broadly evangelical churches, but it's, I think, beyond that. This idea that we celebrate life so we don't grieve, that funerals are peppy times and happy. And I hate it. because I think it cuts out our opportunity to grieve what is truly sorrowful. That death is the consequence of sin. It is that God himself grieves its existence. And that grieving something does not mean that you're declaring it victor, that it cannot be overcome, but simply to acknowledge what it is in the moment. My understanding has always been that if we cannot properly grieve, if we cannot be sad and angry in the face of death, we cannot appreciate the full ramifications of the resurrection, mm-hmm. and of the hope of life, that the one mm-hmm. comes with the other. And so mm-hmm. Going back to Jairus's daughter, right, where it felt like almost he was negating their weeping, and the troublingness of encountering this grieving family and being like, she's napping. Instead, to see this Jesus who, even though, like in that account, he knows that he will resuscitate Lazarus, that he will come up from the dead, he still pauses to grieve alongside those who are grieving.
I also think there's something so helpful, just thinking about the liturgical season that we're in as well, that, Lent is a time to sit in our grief and in the things that are difficult, and not to kind of self-flagellate, but to kind of look honestly in the face of the evil that we experience in our world, and the loss that we've suffered, and the reality of our mortality, and the ways that texts like this claim that God is present in solidarity with us in so many of those things.
So we have in this season of Lent, inherently built in it is this meditation on death and grieving. On Ash Wednesday, it is declared to us as we have ashes on our forehead. From dust we come, to dust we will return. And it's again telling to read this within this season. I think when we decided to do this, it felt like we were doing it during Lent, but it wasn't inherently tied to Lent. And the more that we actually have these conversations, the more it feels like this is really a Lenten meditation. And I am grateful for that. And so in that light, we have the grieving Mary. We have Martha, who is grieving, but not particularly emotive in her encounter with Jesus. And then we have Mary, who is explicitly so. So we've kind of talked about it a bit, but when she knows that Jesus is calling for her, she quickly goes, and it says that she comes and that she kneels at his feet, and says to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And so she weeps at his feet. And there is something beautiful here about Mary's faith and Mary's honesty. One commentator that I read was talking about how when we encounter Mary, that she is always at the feet of Jesus. We see it in Luke 10; she's learning at the feet of Jesus, and we see it at John 11. And 11 here, she's at the feet of Jesus, and in 12 we have, which is alluded to at the start of John 11, where Mary is anointing the feet of Jesus again at his feet. And to read her as this character of profound devotion, that even in her grief while she is weeping, she is doing it in this posture of devotion to Jesus, of recognizing who he is.
Yeah, and I think in important ways too. I mean, the decision to name Mary in verse 2 here as the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair is another kind of foreshadowing of the crucifixion to come. I mean, the reader going through this the first time doesn't know that, but by the time you've reached the end of the story and you're working back through, there are overtones that the crucifixion is coming, I think, even there.
So we've talked in a lot of ways about the profoundness of grief here and how that's encountered, and it's significant for this season. And I think it's also important for us to read that in light of where this falls in the gospel narrative and John, and moving us towards the crucifixion. But it's also worthwhile for us to talk about what this passage is communicating to us about who Jesus is, both as humanity and as divinity. We've talked about how we have this profound picture, right, of a grieving God. But we haven't talked too terribly much about what this passage is telling us about his divinity. And what we see tucked in here in his statement, in his response to Martha in verse 25 and 26, is one of John's I am statements. Olivia, can you talk a bit more about how that fits in John's broader account?
Yeah, so it's a feature that's really distinctive of this gospel. And we talked about it a little bit with the conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, in that he kind of gestured towards the I am statements that will occur later in the gospel, already in chapter 4, when he said, I who am speaking to you am he. You know, there are a number of these kind of formulaic statements. I am the light of the world. I am the gate for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. This statement falls kind of in the middle of them. So we will see, for example, later on in John 15, Jesus's statement that I am the vine. But what's happening here, again, I think, is a kind of a quick turn from talking about the resurrection in a very general sort of way to a very powerful claim that Jesus makes, that I am the resurrection, that it is in his own person that the resurrection exists.
A turn from what would have been widely accepted to something explicit to the ministry of Jesus.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. So as you say, you know, there's a diversity of views about the afterlife in ancient Judaism of this period, but there were certainly Jews that believed in a resurrection, kind of broadly speaking. But for Jesus to say, I am the resurrection, is a different kind of claim, I think. And there's another moment of foreshadowing here, of course, that you know, the reader who knows the end of the story knows that Jesus himself will rise from the dead. But for now, we're just thinking about Lazarus and his experience of resurrection.
Yeah. It's amazing how much theology is really tucked into this passage. We have, like we talked about Martha's declaration that he is the Messiah, and then this I am statement, and not to underplay the miracle itself, right? That he is in fact one who raises them from the dead. And I was thinking, I had made this comment a couple of weeks ago, and it came up in our discussion this last round about her faith, of the woman who is healed from the flow of blood, that her faith is a component in Jesus' ability to heal her. There's this fluidity or this boundedness to Jesus' miraculous abilities that we see come out in that text, when it also says that when he's in Nazareth, he's not able to do many miracles on the grounds of the lack of faith. And what we had mentioned in the discussion was this, what to me was profound, was the sense that this miracle and many miracles are not like Gideon's cloth, right? Like, I do it so that people will believe me. That the faith precedes it. And I found telling in this particular passage that there's almost a reverse of that. So there's this profound sense that this particular miracle is to instill faith in others. He, to the disciples, tells them in verse 15 that he is glad that he's not there, so that they are able to believe, so that they can see what he is able to do. And then we see it again right before Lazarus is raised, this declaration in 42 as he's praying, that he's saying these things for the sake of the crowd standing there, so that they can believe that God has sent him. And I think we can't underscore, right, the power of miracles to draw towards faith. And I feel the need to caveat that in particular, because that faith is a component in, and that in Jesus' ability to heal, and also that they have this apologetic ability, and that Jesus has comfortability with both of those understandings of miracle working, so that it's both grows one in faith and can renew one to faith, and is a way to care for those of faith.
Yeah, and just thinking kind of up a level from the what happens within the story to the kind of overall framing of the Gospel of John. Belief or faith as a response to these signs is a really kind of consistent motif. And then by John 20, the writer says of the whole gospel, these things are written so that you may believe. So right. There is this kind of tensive relationship between the things that the characters within the story see and the response of faith, and then the things that the audience of the gospel itself sees, and that being a kind of call to belief as well.
So we have this richness within this story and broadly in the Gospel of John about the emphasis of belief and faith. And we see the raising of Lazarus as something that both brings people to faith, as verse 45, which we didn't read, talks about, but also this deepening of faith that presumably is happening with both Mary and Martha and the disciples, who are all witnesses to this. With that in mind, it's helpful to think about, who is this Jesus that they have belief in? What is that? What are we learning about the contours of who Jesus is within this passage?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm struck by a couple of things. Larissa, you've talked already quite a bit about the kind of deep humanity of Jesus in this text, but also some of the most elevated Christology that we've seen right. So far. And that, to me, is a very real feature of the Gospel of John. So, you know, on the one hand, Jesus is a human being who is made angry by suffering. He is someone who is in really close and loving relationships with this family. As you said, you know, it's mentioned several times that Jesus loves not just Lazarus, but Martha and Mary, that he has close relationships with all of these characters.
You know, I find that actually a compelling thing to pause on, right? The idea that Jesus has friends.
Yeah.
Purely just to say, I think in like the broad narrative of Jesus, it's like we have Jesus as this personality that in common connotation kind of stands out apart from. He has these disciples who he's teaching, but they're, as I keep referring to them, a little dopey, a little, you know, they're more like his students that he's ferrying along. And then we have him alone, like in the high priestly prayer in John 17, right? Mm-hmm. This Jesus who is either alone or doing stuff for other people. But this image of Jesus as a man with friends, that he loves deeply these other people. And presumably it's not because he's been to their house twice, right? Like we only have these two vignettes of his interactions with this family. But in order to have the depth of relationship that we see in those, it's clear that he has repeated interactions with them. And I, there was a song that was very popular in contemporary Christian music in my childhood, like Jesus is a Friend of Mine. Olivia, does this ring any bells for you?
Yes, I think so.
I could probably sing it, but I'm not going to. We keep using the phrase intimacy, but almost like this, the idea of him as friend and to put Jesus in that light as one who in his humanity is capable of having peer relationships, even though there's lordship, right? Even though there is clearly, like Jesus is divine, he is able to heal them, he teaches them, this sense of commonness with them, this comfortability, yeah, I think can change the way that we think about Jesus and make him more accessible to us.
Yeah, I think about the very kind of trite joke I saw somewhere about, you know, one of the many unsung miracles of Jesus's life is that he managed to have close friendships in his 30s. But, you know, we do actually see Jesus in very close relationship. You know, repeatedly the text says in different terms that that he loved them, that he loved Lazarus, that he loved Martha, and in verse 5, it says, you know, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, kind of piled on one name after the other.
Right.
So we've talked a bit about, you know, some of the very human characteristics of Jesus in this text, but it's also worth reiterating the kind of elevated Christology, the really kind of robust claims about divinity that we see here as well. And we've talked about the kind of lofty nature of Martha's confession that Jesus is the Christ and the Son of God coming into the world, that, you know, I think for many readers that could have overtones of the prologue. I think the theme of Jesus as life is very significant. When we get to John 14, that will be another one of the I am statements that Jesus will say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So this isn't just foreshadowing about Lazarus's resurrection and coming back to life, but it's a deep kind of claim about who Jesus is. But the theme of life also joins with the motif of light. We see this not just here in this chapter. So in verse 9, Jesus has this kind of enigmatic statement about there being 12 hours of daylight and that those who walk during the day do not stumble because they see the light of this world. Elsewhere in the Gospel of John, Jesus will, with another I am statement, claim to be the light of the world. But already right at the beginning in the prologue, we see language like in him was life and that life was the light of all people. And the light shines in the darkness and the darkness does not overcome it. And so the kind of intermingled motifs of life and light, I think, come through here as well.
Yeah, it's compelling to see this high Christology in our passage today as it's interwoven with this deep humanity of Jesus, that these two views of Jesus that can feel like they're competing are interwoven so carefully. And I think that's a beautiful meditation for us in the season to think about this deeply human and deeply divine Jesus. And it's something that we'll see as well in Luke 1, which we'll talk about next week.
Yeah, so I have been struck as we work through this series, not just at the kind of tensive relationship between the divine Jesus and the human Jesus, but the ways in which these women make that particularly visible. Because yeah. I think that there are readings that underappreciate the kind of roundedness of women as characters that associate them with just that kind of material, bodily, sort of physical level of reality. But we have found that women like the Samaritan woman in John 4 or Martha here are also capable of engaging in really lofty theological dispute. Make important confessions about who Jesus is and then function as witnesses to those realities to the audiences around them. But what I think we'll see next time as we turn to Luke 1, so we're moving backwards in the chronology of Jesus's life, but in some ways we are moving towards arguably the loftiest theological confession voiced by a woman, which is to Mary's Magnificat. So we saw the Samaritan woman in John 4 talking about Jesus as the one who told her everything that she ever did. We've now seen in an even more kind of elevated vein, Martha confess Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. But we will see in the hymn of Mary in Luke 1 next time an even richer portrayal of who Jesus is and what it is that his movement inaugurates, even while she is speaking about the life and actions of a very human baby. And I think yeah. I look forward, Larissa, to mulling over this passage with you as we both have young children to think about what it would mean as a mother of a baby and all of its vulnerability to cast this kind of vision for who Jesus is going to be.
Yeah, I think it'll be really beautiful. I hope you guys will join us when we get into that text next week. And in the meantime, we'll have our next discussion on both of the passages about Mary and Martha this Sunday at 12:30 on Zoom. We'll see you there.